Turn it down. Okay, looking to see if we have any really new people. We don't have any really new people. You're all veterans, right? Anyone really, really new? Really? Okay, good. Okay. So, yesterday, we discussed chapter 9. Anyone that wasn't here yesterday? Several of you were not here yesterday. Okay. Too bad. No, I'll do a little review. Chapter 9 and chapter 10 come right in the middle of Bhagavad Gita. 18 chapters. The end of chapter 9 and the beginning of chapter 10 is the balancing point, the exact middle of Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 9 is called Most Confidential Knowledge. And most confidential knowledge is our relationship with Krishna. Confidential knowledge is the soul that is us, distinct from matter. More confidential knowledge is the soul is subordinate to the Supreme Soul. Some people have an idea of Aham Brahmasmi, but they don't have that more confidential knowledge that there is Para Brahman and there's Brahman, the supreme living entity and the subordinate living entity. And most confidential knowledge is that relationship between the two, and from the side of the devotee, it's devotion and love and service. And from Krishna, he discloses a number of very wonderful things in chapter 9 of his regard for those who have such devotion for him. So, devotional service unto Krishna is chapter 9. And chapter 10 is having disclosed that. And by the way, the entire chapter, almost from second verse of chapter 8, Krishna's just talking. It's a one way. It's not just a question answer. It's Krishna speaking, chapter 8, because at the beginning of chapter 8 is question. And then, so there is a natural connection between attaining the supreme devotional service and the opulences of the Absolute. That's the title of chapter 10. Opulences of the Absolute. The word in Sanskrit for opulence, well, there's several of them. In this case, it's vibhuti. V-I-B-H-U-T-I, vibhuti. And if you read carefully in Canto 1, Chapter 3 of Srimad Bhagavatam, that chapter largely is describing, or it's in response to the sages of Naimisharanya's question about those forms of the Lord as they appear in this world. So in the beginning, chapter 3, it starts with the Purusha avatars. Purusha avatars means the forms of Vishnu in relation to creation. And there's three. Although there's actually one. They're just different functions and therefore different names of the same entity. The Purusha avatars for the purpose of creation. And then the other categories of avatars, they're not delineated, but other forms of the Lord as they appear in the world. And then there's a very important verse. In fact, it's the principal utterance of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, comes in that chapter, where Krishna says, of all these, and he lists himself, he's listed as one, rather, Sutta says, of all of them, one is the source of all the other ones. Krishna, Swayam Bhagavan Krishna, is the source of all the other ones. And then additional features of the Lord that appear in this world are described, the manus, and vibhutis is mentioned. Vibhutis are opulences that are of the spiritual world reflected in this world, as a reflection is not the same as the object that is reflected. Like, here's an apple, here's a mirror, and there's a reflection of the apple in the mirror. Something like that. So here, in the spiritual world, there's unlimited opulences. In fact, the Lord of all those opulences is called Bhagavan. He's one who possesses all opulences. That's the meaning of Bhagavan. Bhaga, Van. Van means one who possesses. Like there's this Acharya Van, Purusho Veda. One who has relationship with Acharya becomes the knower of the Vedas through that Acharya. Or, anyway, Van means one who possesses. And Bhaga, specifically, Parashramuni and Vishnu Purana delineates the meaning of Bhagavan. He has all bhagas or opulences in full. Bhagavan. And he identifies the six primary opulences. So there's opulences of the Supreme Lord in the spiritual world, and there's opulences of the Supreme Lord in this world. Bhagas and vibhutis. And the vibhutis are unlimited. And in this chapter, one of the features of this chapter is Arjuna asks Krishna, please describe your opulences, your vibhutis. And by remembering and meditating upon your vibhutis, one will remember you. How can I always remember you? He wants to be fixed in that constant remembrance of Krishna that Krishna described at the end of chapter 9. If you remember from yesterday evening, Manmana. So how to always think of you? 10 follows 9. How to always think of you? So one way to always think of Krishna is to consider things of this world and how Krishna's opulences are present in this world. Of course, actually everything comes from Krishna, but his opulences are opulent. And he's the source of that opulence. So the title of the chapter is Vibhuti Yoga. And we mentioned, so earlier today, those that attended the late morning, midday program, we discussed the four essential verses of the entire Bhagavad Gita that are found in this chapter 10. They're called the Chatur Shloki, the four essential verses that summarize the essence of the entire Bhagavad Gita. And if you want to know Bhagavad Gita, learn those four verses and you'll understand Bhagavad Gita. In fact, you'll understand Krishna. And you'll be very enlivened by understanding Krishna and those four verses. And what it says in those four verses is what happens is, wow, one is very enthusiastic to remain fixed in devotion to Krishna. And then what Krishna does, so we'll cover that. So I want to make one little mention, as we did this morning. Chapter 10, verse number 7. Chapter 10, verse number 7. The verse reads in Sanskrit, Etam vibhutim yogam cha mama yoveti tatvataha So vikalpena yogena yujate natra sangshayaha. Right in the first line is the title of the chapter. Vibhuti Yoga. The Sanskrit of this, the title of chapter 10 is Vibhuti Yoga. And Krishna is saying here, one who is factly convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. Na sangshayaha. No doubt. So what is that? The opulence and mystic power. We heard from chapter 9 about Krishna's mystic power. Remember? Krishna, in the beginning of chapter 9, was discussing, I call it, his Upanishadic double talk. Everything is within him, and everything is not within him. That he is within everything, and he's outside of everything. You got whiplash, like, whoa. What's going on? So, he has mystic powers. He's not one of us. We're not like him. We're not comparable to him. We're like him in tiny representation. But his opulences are unlimited, and his mystic power is unlimited. He can simultaneously be within everything and outside of everything. It's like, you know, be in the room and outside the room at the same time. We can't do that. We can be in the room, and we can be outside the room. We can't be simultaneously in the room and outside the room. But Krishna can. In fact, he can be inside everything and outside of everything. That's his yoga maishvaryam. And here it's vibhuti yoga. It's his vibhuti, the superlative opulence of his opulences is that he is the source of everything. So now we're going to do a little summary. The first seven verses are a group, and in that group of seven, even after Krishna has described the most confidential knowledge, he says, I'm not going to tell you something even better. Like, what's that? It's in one sense, it's the stimulations of our ecstatic love for him. So, and then he goes on to say, nobody understands me. Those who are superlatively learned don't understand me. And they don't understand because I'm their very source of their power and in fact their existence. And then here's this opulence. He who knows me as unborn, ajam, beginningless, anadim, as the supreme Lord of all the worlds, he only, undiluted among men, is freed from all sins. And then he lists, verses 4 and 5, a whole bunch of things. Like during the morning class, there was like, if Krishna is the source of all things, then is he also the source of bad things? Well, here in this list, in 4 and 5, is some of those bad things. There's like good things. Intelligence, knowledge, freedom from doubt and delusion, forgiveness, truthfulness, control of the senses, control of the mind, happiness. Whoops, then there's distress. Birth, death, that's not good things. Fear, that's not good things. Nonviolence, equanimity, satisfaction, austerity, charity, fame, and infamy. All these various qualities of living beings are created by me alone. Everything. There isn't something, Prabhupada said it like this, there's in this world there's two things. There's Krishna, and there's Krishnas, and there's not a third thing. But then he went on to say, there's no void in the creation of God. Because void means, well, there's nothing. So how can there be the existence of nothing which is outside of the existence of God? No such thing. There's Krishna and there's Krishnas. There's not a third thing. Interesting, huh? Then he repeats. The seven great sages, and before them the four other great sages, and the Manus, and you name it. All living beings within the various planets descend. They're coming from me, and all other beings come from them, and I'm the source of it all. One who factually, now this verse, 10:7, one who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So, paraphrased, we discussed a little bit this morning, that which exists before we exist, you cannot know what that is because it existed before you exist. You can conjecture. Perhaps maybe it seems to me that all evidence points to it must be, but you don't know. That's reason and logic. And sense perception also, you can't, because your senses, it's before you existed, so you can't know. But there isn't one way to know. And that's by disclosure from what existed before you existed. Then you can know. And otherwise you can't know. So the faithless, as is discussed in the beginning of the 9th chapter, the faithless can't know. I mean, it's not like too bad, but it's too bad. They can't know. So to go to this stage of the message of Bhagavad Gita, at least preliminary faith must be there. The preliminary faith says, I don't know what it is, but there's something that's greater than all of this facade that's going on. Remove the facade and take all the temporary things away, and there's a reality, a higher reality that's there. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's there. That much. So therefore, let me hear what you have to say. Well, Krishna, what's your message? Let me hear. That much. But faithless persons can't enter into this message of Bhagavad Gita. Even if you're a Sanskrit scholar, you can't enter into the message of Bhagavad Gita. It's a descending message. Another kind of knowledge. So that's the first section. We're one quarter done. Then comes these 8, 9, 10, and 11, the four essential verses of the whole Bhagavad Gita. And the first two are about the devotee, and the next two are about Krishna. So the devotee, the first one is, Krishna is declaring, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo, I am the source of everything. Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo, Matak Sarvam Pravartate. Everything comes from me. I am the source of everything. It's like forwards and backwards. I am the source of everything. Everything comes from me. Thus knowing, one engages in my devotional service. He essentially said the same thing in the previous verse, but now it's very, very clear. I am the source of everything. Everything comes from me. Thus knowing, one engages in my devotional service. And when you engage in devotional service, knowing who that is that you're serving, because constitutionally all living entities are servants. Everyone without exception is serving someone. Without exception, they're serving multiple someones, because it's our constitutional nature. When we repose that serving propensity upon He who is actually the source of everything, knowing that He's the source of everything, Buddha Bhava Samanvita, there's a transformation that takes place inside the heart of that person. Buddha indicates one who possesses buddhi. Bhava Samanvita. The way the Prabhupada has translated that bhava samanvita is with great attention, but with great enthusiasm, bhava, enthusiastic, enlivened service, unrestrained jubilation and enthusiasm in service, because we're serving source of everything. And then the next verse is further describing how that devotee serves. Text 9. The thoughts of my pure devotee dwell in me. Their lives are fully devoted to my service. And they derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. Like, devotees get together and it's Krishna Krishna. It's kirtan and Krishna katha. Katayantascha mam nityam tushanticha ramanticha. There's so much tushti and ramanti, there's no interest in other things. One feels completely satisfied. Mentioned when you've had a meal and you're feeling full, and somebody may say, "Would you like some more of this and that?" No, tushti. I'm full. I'm satisfied. Thank you. So one doesn't want anything else. By that affinity and enthusiastic attachment for Krishna, one doesn't want non-Krishna. In airlines in India, I think they still, some of them still do it. Air India still does it. They serve meals when they have flights. So the lady pushing the cart, stewardess, comes down the aisle and says, "Would you like veg or non-veg?" And my answer is, "No, thank you." "Well, would you like non-veg?" "No, thank you." "Would you like anything?" "Well, they take some water." "Oh, okay." It's not just like it's a rule. It's when there's a relationship with Krishna, who wants something outside of Krishna? Tell another little anecdotal. As you've noticed, I like distributing Mahaprasadam. So one time I was visiting in Bombay, and I was in my room, and there's some people that come to see me, and I brought some Mahaprasadam from Radha Govinda Burfi. And, I reached to give some Mahaprasadam to a little boy who was right in front, and he just looked at me. I thought maybe he's shy. Okay, so I won't disturb him. He gave to other people and came back to him, and they saw they were taking Mahaprasadam, and said, "Oh, thank you." And I came back to him, and he just looked at me. His mother leaned over and whispered something in his ear, and his hand went out like this. I said, what'd you tell him? He said, "I told him it was offered to Krishna." I said, "Wow, here's a little boy. You offer some sweets, and he knows what it is. He's not going to take it unless it's offered to Krishna." And I'm not going to give him something that's not offered to Krishna, but he wouldn't take it until his mom said it was offered to Krishna. Amazing, huh? He was like, 4 years old, something like that. And now he's, as a teenager, and he's still like that. Just his life is with Krishna. When that's in the heart, then you say yes to Krishna, and you say no, thank you, or just stare at the person, or something. The answer is no, if it's not Krishna, because life is for Krishna. That's all. Very simple. If it's not in relation to Krishna, it's no interest. Because one is tushti, one is satisfied, and ramanti. They're looking for happiness and bringing the senses to some sense object and finding sense gratification, that kind of happiness. Not interested. No, thank you. Because the happiness is happiness in relation with Krishna, in my relationship with Krishna. So that's the first two of the Chaturshloki verses. And then when Krishna, now what happens on Krishna's side, this is really confidential. What does Krishna feel? What does Krishna do? Krishna feels that devotion of the devotee, and Krishna reciprocates. Here's verse 10. The Sanskrit is very nice. Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhiyogam tam yena mam upiyanti te. So, tesham, unto those persons described in the first two verses. What's their essence or their nature? Satata yuktanam. They're always engaged. And our acharyas are very specific. They're attached to their relationship with Krishna. They're always engaged in their relationship with Krishna. That's the satata yuktanam. Intimately united with Krishna. They don't want anything else. They're attached to Krishna. Like somebody, like this little child is attached to his kartals. Take kartals away and he's, wailing and crying. Then he'll find something else to get attached to. But that when attachment to Krishna is there, there's nothing else to get attached to. There isn't a substitute. And you can't take Krishna away from that person. Because they're attached. It's in the heart. It's not something external. That circumstance created. It's internal. It's attachment to Krishna. Satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam. Bhaj, same as the last verse of chapter 6. Bhajate yo mam. Bhaj, this word bhaj is the root word of bhakti. So, bhajatam priti purvakam, with complete affection and love. That's the kind of service they do. Unto those persons, the dami, Krishna gives bodhi yogam tam. He gives the intelligence by which yena mamupiyantite, they can come to me. We're involved in a very complex situation called material life. It's very complicated. I'm sure you've noticed. And when Krishna sees we're in this maze of stuff and don't really know whether to turn right or left sometimes, if we have this quality, Krishna gives the intelligence whether to turn left or turn right or whatever. That will get you to him. It's a promise. It's from his side, his love for those who have love for him. He's not ungrateful. He's not a stone. He's very, very loving. And this is a reciprocation. He gives the buddhi how to come to him. It's the greatest of all gifts. Because it finishes the whole sojourn of material existence, birth after birth. You come to him eternally. And then the last of the Chaturshloki verses, to show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. So we discussed this at length earlier. All these wonderful things come as a result of hearing and with faith, understanding Krishna's position, engaging his devotional service, receiving intelligence, receiving ecstatic, enthusiastic feelings of wishing to serve. Krishna, seeing that, he reciprocates. He gives us the intelligence by which we can come to him. But I have a doubt. What's that? The doubt is, what about all these countless numbers of lifetimes of material existence? Isn't there some residual tendency to fall back to our material ways and material existence? The bungee cord effect. Maybe that means something to you. Long. How long? We can't count how long. Since time immemorial, we've been in material existence, and now here we are in material existence, and we're out of material existence just like that through bhakti. And Krishna give us intelligence. What about those material tendencies? You know, like the example of the blades of the fan spinning. You stop the electricity, and the blades of the fan are still spinning. Tendency to continue in material activity, once again, resume fruitive notions, and even in the arena of devotional service. Isn't it a tendency? So what about those tendencies? Krishna says, don't worry. I'll personally take charge. And it's, the commentary of our acharyas make it really explicit, like three times over. Really? We don't have to do anything? Really? You don't have to do anything? Because you're already done. Your love for Krishna is awakened. Your enthusiasm to serve Krishna is awakened. That tendency, Krishna takes charge of. How does he do it? With the shining lamp of knowledge, Jnana Dipena. He destroys the darkness born of ignorance. Tam Ajnanajam Tamaha. Those residual tendencies, Krishna takes care of. And our acharyas refer to a verse from earlier chapter where Krishna says, Yoga Kshema Vaham Yaham. Whatever they lack, I provide. Whatever they have, I preserve. And he does it personally, not indirectly. Through some agency, I'll send somebody over there to take care of it. Personally, Vishwanath says, like a bee, he enters into the lotus of our heart. And he personally destroys that tendency. Because that tendency keeps us here. That tendency, you know, in real terms, that tendency keeps us, even in the realm of devotional service, stuck in material consciousness, even we're in devotional service. You know, the fruitive tendency thing. I do so that I'll get. It's so strong. Think about it, or just notice it a little bit. Just put your antenna up and get the signal of fruitive tendency. How much does it still exist? It's really strong. Really strong. And bhakti is without it. Rupa Goswami teaches us. Anyavilashata shunyam. Avilash means desire. Anya avilash, no other desire. Which ones? Karma and jnana. Zippo. Squeaky clean. Gone. Completely. There's only one thing left. Service to Krishna. So here comes some difficulty. Great. The opportunity for serving Krishna. How often do we think like that? Oh, get rid of this difficulty. The opportunity, it's the way to get rid of it is to transcend it. Not like manipulate it out of the picture. But it's an opportunity to serve Krishna. Fantastic. Etc. So one who is fixed in devotion, like Maharaj Ambarish, here comes this fiery demon heading at him from Durvas Muni, who's powerful Brahmin and mystic yogi and about to finish him, kill him. The Bhagavatam says, Maharaj Ambarish, his feet didn't move, his arms didn't move, his mind didn't move. Come on, something flying at you. You don't even have to think about it. Your arms go up to check that something. It's involuntary. It happens. And the mind, you're like, whoa, what's this? Even his mind didn't move. How's that possible? He's a Kshatriya. And he's human. He's a transcendentalist. It's incredible, Maharaj Ambarish's position. And Sudarshan Chakra took care of the fire demon. And so on, the rest of the Leela. There's another very nice, because not so long ago was Nrisimha Chaturdasi. In our Acharya's commentary, it describes one of the ways in which Hiranyakashipu tried to kill Prahlad was he pushed him off a cliff. So specifically, the Acharyas say, Lord Vishnu didn't come immediately as Prahlad was falling. Ooh. He could have. He's Lord Vishnu. But he didn't. Why? He was examining Prahlad. So he kept falling and falling and falling and falling and falling. And Prahlad's mind didn't change for a moment. Whoa, maybe Vishnu isn't going to protect me. And start screaming or something. Help! He didn't. He had full faith. And just before he crashed, Lord Vishnu caught him. And similarly, again and again in Krishna's Vrajalila, the demons were sent by Kamsa. And again, Krishna was protecting his cowherd boys and the cows. And their fear was not fear of death. They were fearless. They were their fear was separation from Krishna. Like when the cowherd boys were entering into the mouth of Agasura. His top of his jaw was up in the sky. He was so big. And bottom jaw on the ground, and they walked into the mouth of Agasura. Well, this isn't a cave. This must be some big serpent. But anyway, Krishna will take care of us. Let's go. And off they went. And Krishna, from a distance, he saw them entering into the mouth. And Krishna became bewildered. Krishna became bewildered by his own yogamaya potency for his own happiness. And his bewilderment was specific. How will my cowherd boys exist without me? Because he knew how attached they were to him. So he wanted to check them so they wouldn't have to experience that separation from him. But it was too late. They had entered. It's Leela. But it's ecstatic love. That's this platform where there's such attachment for Krishna. When one is so attached to Krishna, whatever residual tendency remains, he removes it. Aham agyana ja, ignorance that's born from tamaha. The root cause of all suffering is ignorance, Prabhupada teaches. Root cause of all suffering is ignorance. And the essence of ignorance is ignoring Krishna. There, from that comes all ignorance. And the darkness of ignorance, the darkness born of ignorance, the misguided ajnana instead of jnana. You know, choosing to go the wrong direction, and we should go towards Krishna. Krishna already said, I'll correct that. And the tendency to choose away from Krishna instead of Krishna, he'll take care of that too. He doesn't interfere with our free will. He just illumines us with knowledge. Directly, personally. It's very nice. This is Krishna. This is a good reason to be Krishna's devotee. He's the best. Of all masters, he's the best. So that's second of four sections. We're halfway done. And then we'll do the last two very quickly. In the third section, Arjuna becomes really ecstatic. And he says, wait a minute, you're not just my friend, you're the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And I've treated you like my friend, and please forgive me for that casual dealing with you, and because you're Param Brahma, Param Davam, Paramam, Purusham, Shashvatam, Divyam. You're the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's not just my opinion. All great learned personalities, they say the same thing. You're it. You're the absolute truth. And now then he ends that section by asking Krishna, please describe the ways in which one can always remember you, like you said at the end of chapter 9. Manmana. And the last section is Krishna lists various opulences by which one can think of Krishna. When there's love and you see something that you know is connected to the object of love, you think of the object. Prabhupada gives this example. It's not so common anymore, but it used to be. And anyway, he said when you see the baby shoes, when children are very small, they have baby shoes. So sometimes people would keep those baby shoes. Used to be from the rear view mirror, now it's a CD or some other awful thing. Some picture of something. So, but it used to be baby shoes. That was like a fad. So Prabhupada said, when you see the shoes of the child, you see the child. Not like they become the shoe, but the affection for the object is awakened by seeing that which is in relation to the object, and you think of the object very strongly. Like some people will at their place of work, they'll have a little photo of their family. I'm working hard in my workplace for them. I'm here for them. And they look at the picture and then they're, okay, I'll keep going on doing this because it's for them, working for the family. So then if there's with these vibhutis, one thinks of Krishna because they're manifestations of Krishna in this world. That which we can see helps us appreciate and have awakened the affection and devotion. This is the connection between chapter 9 and chapter 10. By the opulences, it stimulates our devotion for the object, Krishna. He's the object of our love. And then he ends the chapter by saying, after he lists 82 different opulences, what's the use of all these opulences, my dear Arjuna? For but a spark of my splendor, I maintain and support the whole universe. And that comes back to like the opulence, the superlative opulence of all is he's the source of everything. And in this realm, it's just a spark of him. It's his, the Vishnu forms pervade and support this whole universe. And then comes, you know, the universe. That's the next chapter, the universal form. But a spark of him pervades and supports it. Okay. there's the end of chapter 10. Here's a summary of these opulences mentioned in this chapter, of the opulences of the Absolute, starting with verse 7 and then again verse 8. Krishna is the generating seed of all existence. And then the converse, nothing can exist without Krishna. Another comes in this final section. There's no end to Krishna's manifestations. Everything opulent, beautiful, glorious springs from just a spark of Krishna's splendor, and Krishna's single fragment pervades and supports the entire universe. So there's a little quick summary of the vibhutis mentioned in this chapter. So now we're going to go through the chapter. It's the sound, the whole thing would go up. It's up to the max. This is the backup plan,
yeah.
Just in case. Okay. Okay.
Because you are my dear, giving knowledge that is better than what I've already explained, neither the hosts of demigods
nor
the great sages.
I'm going to go back to the beginning. Take three.
Neither the hope. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Listen again, O mighty Arjuna. Because you are my dear friend, for your benefit, I shall speak to you further. Giving knowledge that is better than what I have already explained, neither the hosts of demigods nor the great sages know my origin or opulences. For in every respect, I am the source of the demigods and sages. He who knows me as the unborn as the beginningless, as the supreme Lord of all the worlds. He only, undiluted among men, is freed from all sins, intelligence, knowledge, freedom from doubt and delusion, forgiveness, truthfulness, control of the senses, control of the mind, happiness and distress, birth, death, fear, fearlessness, non-violence, equanimity, satisfaction, austerity, charity, fame, and infamy. All these various qualities of the living beings are created by me alone. The seven great sages, and before them the four other great sages, and the Manus, progenitors of mankind, come from me, born from my mind, and all the living beings populating the various planets descend from them. One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this, there is no doubt. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me. Their lives are fully devoted to my service, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. Arjuna said, "You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the ultimate abode, the purest, the absolute truth. You are the eternal, transcendental, original person, the unborn, the great." All the great sages, such as Narada, Asita, Devara, and Vyasa, confirm this truth about you, and now you yourself are declaring it to me. Oh Krishna, I totally accept this truth, all that you have told me. Neither the demigods nor the demons, O Lord, can understand your personality. Indeed, you alone know yourself by your own internal potency. O Supreme Person, Origin of all, Lord of all beings, God of gods, Lord of the universe. Please, tell me in detail of your divine opulences by which you pervade all these worlds. O Krishna, O Supreme Mystic, how shall I constantly think of you, and how shall I know you? In what various forms are you to be remembered, O Supreme Personality of Godhead? O Janardana, again, please describe in detail the mystic power of your opulences. I am never satiated in hearing about you, for the more I hear, the more I want to taste the nectar of your words. Personality of Godhead said, "Yes, I will tell you of my splendorous manifestations. But only of those which are common, O white man, for my opulence is limitless. I am the super soul, O white man, seated in the hearts of all living entities. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end of all beings. Of the Adityas, I am Vishnu. Of lights, I am the radiant sun. Of the months, I am Arichi. And among the stars, I am the moon. Of the Vedas, I am the Sama. Of the demigods, I am Indra, the king of heaven. Of the senses, I am the mind. And in living beings, I am the living force, consciousness. Of all the Rudras, I am Lord Shiva. Of the Yakshas and Rakshasas, I am the Lord of Wealth, Kubera. Of the Vasus, I am Fire, Agni. And of mountains, I am the Air. Of priests, O Arjuna, no need to be the chief, my husband. Of generals, I am Kartikeya. And of bodies of water, I am the ocean. Of the great sages, I am Vidya. Of vibrations, I am the transcendental form. Of sacrifices, I am the chanting of the holy names, Japa. The movable things, I am the Himalayas. Of all trees, I am the Banyan. And of the sages among the demigods, I am Narada. Of the Gandharvas, I am Chitrarama. And among perfected beings, I am the sage Kapila. Of horses, no need to be Uchaisava, produced during the churning of the ocean for nectar. Of lordly elephants, I am Ayaravata. And among men, I am the monarch. Of weapons, I am the thunderbolt. Among cows, I am the Surabhi. Of causes for procreation, I am Kandaka, the god of love. And of serpents, I am Vasuki. Of the many-hooded Nagas, I am Ananta. And among the aquatics, I am the demigod Varuna. Of departed ancestors, I am Aryama. And among the dispensers of law, I am Yama, the lord of death. Among the Daitya demons, I am the devoted Pranad. Among subduers, I am Time. Among beasts, I am the lion. And among birds, I am Gavana. Of purifiers, I am the wind. Of the wielders of weapons, I am Rama. Of fishes, I am the shark. And of flowing rivers, I am the Ganges. Of all creations, I am the beginning and the end, and also the middle, O Arjuna. Of all sciences, I am the spiritual science of the self, and among magicians, I am the conclusive proof. Of letters, I am the letter A, and among the compound words, I am the dual compound. I am also inexhaustible time, and of creators, I am Brahma. Devouring death, and I am the generating principle of all that is yet to be. Among women, I am fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience. Of the hymns in the Sama Veda, and the Brihat Sama, and of poetry, I am the Gayatri. Of month, I am Magasiyasa, November, December, and of seasons, I am a flower bearing spring. I am also the gambling of cheats, and of the splendid I am the strength. I am victory, I am adventure, and I am the strength of the strong. Of the descendants of Vrishni, I am Vasudeva, and of the Pandavas, I am Arjuna. Of the sages, I am Vyasa, and among great thinkers, I am Ushana. command all means of suppressing lawlessness, I am punishment. And of those who seek victory, I am morality. Of secret things, I am silence. And of the wise, I am the wisdom. Furthermore, O Arjuna, I am the generating seed of all existence. There is no being, moving or non-moving, that can exist without me. O mighty conqueror of enemies, there is no end to my divine manifestations. What I have spoken to you is but a mere indication of my infinite utterances. Know that all opulent, beautiful, and glorious creations spring from but a spark of my splendor. But what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? With a single fragment of myself, I have obeyed and supported this entire universe.
That's the end of the chapter. The opulences of the Absolute. So with this last verse, it leads into the next verse, the universal form. Arjuna wishes to see that form of Krishna that by which the entire universe is manifest. Since he is the source of it, he wants to see that universal form. There's a very natural and logical flow, as with, you know, conversation between God and his pure devotee. It's the message of Bhagavad Gita and the sequence and connection of the different parts of Bhagavad Gita, section by section and chapter by chapter. It's profound and very beautiful. I encourage that you not only read Bhagavad Gita, but you take part in a systematic study of Bhagavad Gita. Purna Pragya is here, and I assume in addition to teaching Bhagavad Gita classes, some systematic study will also be there. And we need to study it in that systematic way, and you hear the connection between this section, that section, and how the pieces fit together, and then discuss them. The whole message becomes illumined. It's very nice. So this is just it's a nice way to learn a chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So let's see if there's any comments or discussion. Yes.
We have this countless births, right? You're being born from time immemorial so many times.
Yeah.
My question is, every time we are born, are we born on the same earth, or are there other material planets?
Oh yeah. Other. Yeah, not just this place. It's a big place. Big place. Bhutva, bhutva, praviyate. Again and again.
So when we say there's 84 lakhs
species.
Yeah, they're across the
universe. They're physical planets like Earth, but they may not be made of the same elements as Earth. One of the regular topics, and not necessarily favorite, but regular topic that Prabhupada would choose to speak about is there's life on the sun, making reference to chapter 4. Krishna says he spoke this knowledge to the sun god Vivaswan. Where does the sun god reside? On the sun planet. So if the sun god is there, it has his sun. And Vaivasvata Manu, and Manu's son Ikshvaku, and there's the Surya dynasty. Ikshvaku came here to Earth from the sun. So there's, you know, there's civilization in the sun. So one can say, oh, that's silly. You can't have life on the sun. And Prabhupada's reply, why not? Their bodies are of different elements, are suitable elements for habiting there, and as here. The elements making up the bugs and whatever it is that are in the sky, and the fish that are in the water, and beings that are walking on the earth, so suitable to the environment to have bodies. There's life in fire. There's living entities everywhere. Sarvagata. So, yeah, similar to but different from, depending upon the atmosphere, the makeup of that planet. That's the Vedic picture. So, you know, what scientists are looking for, you know, life on Mars and life on Moon and stuff, they're looking for life like us. Using eyes like the eyes that we have to find life that's like our life. And they may not find it. It's a different atmosphere. There's living entities throughout all of creation. That's the indication of the Vedic wisdom. Anything else? Yes?
So, Krishna here says that he is Brihaspati, he is Kartikeya. Like, they are not incarnation, they are not avatars of Krishna.
No.
It's basically qualitative.
The souls, all souls, including Kartikeya and Brihaspati, are Krishna's parts and parcels. And the opulences which they manifest are invested in them from Krishna. So the, you know, the spiritual identity and the physical makeup of what it is that they carry is from Krishna. So when he says I am, it's in the abheda, and let us not forget there's also beta. He's speaking in the beta sense, but there's abheda also. Excuse me, the other way around. He's speaking in the abheda, there's not different, but there's difference. Oneness and difference at the same time. But so, the oneness aspect is, you know, the most glorious of all, whatever you can think of, I am that. And he's also everything else too. And then, he's not. I mean, that's not like he's saying, fire is God, and the shark is God, and the cheats, that's God. But you know, it's an opulence which comes from him. He is the basis and support of that, and therefore it exists in him. But then, remembering what he said in chapter 9, yet it's separate from him. But it's not separate from him. It's not him, but it is him. It's connected to him in that sense. It's him. Inseparable. There isn't some existence that exists apart from him. There's Krishna, and there's Krishnas, and there's not a third thing. So when he's saying this is I am, it's Krishnas. And then there's Krishna.
Where are they? I mean, they are in the different material world.
Where is their abode? Is that what your question is?
Mm-hmm.
Where do they reside? How much time do you have? Lord Shiva is unique. And having spent some time studying Sri Brahma Samhita, I can share with you, there are different features of Lord Shiva that exist in different realms. You know Brahma Samhita verses, some of them. Goloka nami nijadami talesha tasya devi mahesha haridama sarteshu teshu. Sound familiar? A little bit? No. In that verse, Lord Brahma is describing Goloka Dham. And into contrast, he speaks of Devi Dham, Mahesh Dham, Hari Dham, and Goloka Dham. So, Hari, in his commentary, Bhaktisiddhanta says Brahma is looking up from his Dham. That's where he starts from. Devi Dham. That's this place. And then mentioned is Mahesh Dham, and then there's Hari Dham. So Hari Dham is Vaikuntha. And Devi Dham is here. And Mahesh Dham is not here, and it's not there. It's another Dham. So what is it? The other devatas, they're in Devi Dham. He's in this unique position. He's one of a kind. he's not like the devatas, and he's not Lord Hari. It's Mahesh in Mahesh Dham. So again, how much time do you have? He has manifestations that are described in Chaitanya Charitamrita, for example, where there's an aspect of him that is Sadashiva, that's in the Vaikuntha region. And then there's another aspect of him, and which has its own Dham, that is described in Brihat Bhagavatamrita. You familiar with that title? You've heard it. Okay. It's a commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, one way to describe it, written by Sanatan Goswami. And it's in two parts. And in the second part, there's the main character is Gopa Kumar, literally a cowherd boy from Vrindavan, who is searching for Madan Mohan. And he goes to different places, different realms, to experience and to find Madan Mohan, and he finds other things, and he keeps going and keeps going, and eventually finds Madan Mohan. So it's very. But through that sojourn, he experiences different realms, and one of the places he experiences is the abode of Lord Shiva. One of the abodes of Lord Shiva. That to get there, he goes through the entire universe, through the coverings of the universe, and it describes what's in the coverings of the universe, and that's very fascinating. And then he gets on the other side of the covering of the universe, and lo and behold, here comes Lord Shiva descending into this realm from his realm. But he's not in Vaikuntha, and he's not in Devi Dham. He's in this other Mahesh Dham.
Kailash?
No, that's another one of his abodes. Kailash is a third abode of Lord Shiva. He's a complicated, multifaceted entity. The Kailash is the abode of Lord Shiva, who's worshipped or recognized or understood as the Lord of Pradhan, or Parvati. And his abode, where he presides and takes ultimate responsibility for the dissolution of the universe, is in Kailash. So the from the Western theological perspective, he's part of the Trinity, which is never mentioned anywhere in the Vedas, but it's thought of like that because in Christianity there's Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So they just keep using that terminology. We're looking at Hinduism from a Western theologian's perspective. They, you know, the guna avatars, Vishnu, Brahma, and Mahesh. Vishnu presides over goodness, Brahma presides over passion, creation, and Lord Shiva presides over destruction. And his abode is in Kailash. And then there's another place called Maha Kalapur, the great time, the time of dissolution. It's where the 11 Rudras, if you recall from, or maybe you haven't read it, in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where it's describing the unfolding of creation, the first entities from Lord Brahma are the four Kumaras. And he requests the four Kumaras to assist him in creating Praja, to fill up the universe he just created. And they say, no thanks, Dad, we don't want to do that service. We want to stay brahmacharis. So he becomes angry, and from his brow comes Lord Shiva. And then quickly that Lord Shiva expands into 11 Rudras, and they start destroying that which Lord Brahma just created. So he instructs them, stop. Just do meditation. And go reside in this place. I'll let you know when it's okay, when it's time for destruction. I'll give you a call. Until then, just for a while, just do some meditation. 4,320,000,000 years from now, a little meditation. So their residence is at the bottom of the universe, in this place that's called Maha Kalapur. And when it's time for devastation, they do the devastation. So now we have at least four distinct abodes of Lord Shiva. Now go back to your question. Where is the place of residence of Lord Shiva? Well, it depends on which aspect or feature of Lord Shiva you're speaking about. It's complex. But one thing is that the Bhagavatam is very clear about, except for this Sadashiva Loka, that he's a manifestation for the pastimes of the Lord in the language of Chaitanya Charitamrita. The others are, at the time of devastation, that else is also destroyed. There's one thing that still remains after the devastation of the universe, and that's the abode of Vishnu. Shirodakshay Vishnu's abode is not destroyed. It's just a transcendental abode. It's a little complicated. But you asked the question, so I'm... Does that answer the question you were asking?
I mean, you definitely answered the question, but it's difficult for me to...
Okay. So, other than Lord Shiva, who is a very multifaceted and not easy to understand tattva, Shiva tattva is very complex, and his abode is in different places according to the function or feature that he's manifesting. Other than Lord Shiva, the others are within Devi Dham, and it's destroyed when cosmic annihilation comes. And even when the partial devastation, there's a partial devastation. At the end of each day of Brahma, total annihilation is the end of Brahma's life, and everything is kaput. But at the end of each night, at the end of the day, during the night of Brahma, there's a partial annihilation. And that partial annihilation, it's nicely described in Brihad Bhagavatamrita in detail. But there's a long period of, at the end of his day, there's a long period of drought, so much that everything becomes like really dry, like Arizona. The whole universe becomes very dry for 100 years, no rain. And then there's fire, and everything becomes engulfed in fire. up to and including Swargaloka and everything below. So the demigods become, then their abodes become devastated. Above Swargaloka, there's four other higher planets: Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, and Brahmaloka. The Brihat Bhagavatamrita says, in Maharloka, it gets so hot because of the fire beneath, they get in their vimanas and they go to Tapaloka and hang out for a while till it cools out. And then they come back and do their Maharloka program. But below, Swargaloka, the heavenly planets, are every night, throughout the whole life of Lord Brahma, 360 times 100, that's how many times they're devastated, and then in the beginning of the day, Brahma puts it together again, everything, the sub-creation. That's his seva. So their abodes are temporary. Their duration of life is much longer than ours, but still interrupted. That's Devi Dham. Including Lord Brahma. And, you know, at the end, his abode is destroyed. It's a long duration, but that's also destroyed. Everything within this universe is created. Everything that's created is also destroyed. So those parts of those abodes of Lord Shiva, where it's within the created realm, that's Kailash and Mahakalapur, destroyed. But there's an aspect of Lord Shiva that isn't, and an abode of Lord Shiva that isn't. He's unique and not easy to understand. Yeah. Yeah.
How do we understand when we say Brahma's day and Brahma's night? Because for us, day and night means when we feel sunlight, it is a day.
Yeah.
And when Earth rotates, it's going down, it's a night.
Yeah.
For Brahma, there are millions of suns like that. So
anyway,
from Brahma's day and Brahma's night, but how do we understand that?
Well, you're saying two different things. You know, we think of day and night according to the rising and setting of the sun. And then the two different things are, how is the day and night of Brahma calculated? That's one part. But aside from that, another is, how is it calculated? Well, his night is of equal duration. And his day is 1,000 four yuga cycles. That's how long his day is. And how long is his night? Equal. He sleeps a lot. Or at least that's the night of whether he's sleeping or not. That's the night of Brahma. That's how long it is. Now, how is it calculated? It's calculated. I've never heard an answer to that question. Never heard the question. Nor have I heard an answer to the question. But it's calculated in that manner. The duration of one complete yuga cycle, the four yuga cycles, times 1,000, that's day, and the night is of equal duration. And that's by our solar years. That's how we calculate. The demigods calculate differently, and Brahma calculates differently. But that's how we calculate the duration. Did I answer your question?
Yes, Maharaj, I have one more question. What does day and night mean for Brahma? I mean, for us, day means light and night means no light. For Brahma, what is conceptually, what does it mean day and night for him?
He goes to sleep.
Excuse me, I just have to go.
Huh?
I have to go.
Okay. You have an answer to this, you know, what happens during his night question?
No, I don't. Have to ask Brahma.
You were following up on his. You're okay? He was.
I was asking about the feature of Shambhu.
Yeah. Well, the nomenclature, there's four: Shambhu, Rudra, Shiva, and Mahesh. At least four. Maybe there's more than four. I'm most familiar with Brahma Samhita, where Shambhu is the halo of the glance of Mahavishnu. It's not the glance. It's the halo. Or Bhaktisiddhanta's language is the dim twilight reflection. Or the halo of the glance. It's not the glance. The halo of the glance. Shambhu. And it's Shambhu who impregnates the first act of procreation. Shambhu carries the living entities from Mahavishnu's glance. He carries living entities and the time energy to the Pradhan or Chaya Devi, reflection of Rama Devi, Chaya Devi. And that's Shambhu, that's what he does. So it's an aspect of Lord Shiva, and therefore a name to identify that aspect of Lord Shiva, Shambhu. But it's not, that's the Brahma Samhita use of the nomenclature Shambhu. There may be others in other circumstances, in other places, in other literatures. But that's my frame of reference. That's what I'm particularly accustomed to hearing, Shambhu, in terms of the glance or the halo of the glance. Wait. He's not done yet.
But as per these four realms that
yeah.
One of very very at least one of some of these features of Shiva. So where does this Shambhu?
Well, again, it's complex. It's not like here's a bucket, there's a bucket, there's a bucket, and it's just like which bucket? That's the kind of question, and it's not quite like that. You ready? Here's another more complication. We're familiar with what I described, where the appearance of Lord Shiva from the brow of Lord Brahma. There's a prototype. Oh my God. There's a prototype that appears even before there's Lord Brahma, even before there's a universe, where Mahavishnu, this is in Brahma Samhita, there's one verse in those earlier verses that says from his left side, from his right side, and from his forehead. So let's see now. From his left side comes Garbhadakshay Vishnu. From his right side comes Lord Brahma. And from Mahavishnu's brow comes Shambhu, the prototype. Shambhu. And that Shambhu, where does he reside? Because, you know, that's like what that seems to be the question for tonight. Where are all these personalities? What's their abode? Is it one of, which one of those four is it, or is it another one? His abode is in Kailash. He is that who resides, who presides over the destruction of the universe feature of the Supreme Lord, and that is who presides over Tamagun, and his abode is Kailash, and he can be known as Lord Shiva, or he can also be known as Shambhu. It's very technical. Now,
related Rudraksha, there is one Mukhi Rudraksha. They say it's the Lord. It's very difficult to find on the earth. It's like only probably very few people possess it. They say that Rudraksha itself is a self-manifestation of Shiva. And some say that Rudraksha are the tears of Shiva. So what is Rudraksha? This is
esoteric, and I'm unfamiliar with it. I can't comment. Worshippers of Lord Shiva will likely know the esoteria and be able to answer your question. I'm not a worshipper of Lord Shiva. I've never even heard what you said. I don't know anything about it. Sorry. Yes.
Maharaj, we go back to Godhead again. Is there a chance to fall down again? If by any chance we go back to Godhead?
Did you hear her question? Her question was, when we go back to Godhead, is there a chance we can fall down again from that position? No. I mean, yes and no. And here's the yes part and here's the no part. The yes part is, Prabhupada has made it very clear, the living entity by nature is marginal. We're not Vishnu Tattva, we're Jiva Tattva. And as Jiva Tattva, we can be influenced by the spiritual potency or the material potency, and it's a matter of course, the will of or grace of the Supreme Lord, but it's a free will. We can be this way or that way. So when we return to the spiritual world, it's not that free will is taken away from us. We don't get a lobotomy. We're still with free will. But as Prabhupada explained, we've learned our lesson. We won't make that mistake again. And second is, Krishna makes a promise, I'll protect that devotee. So we're protected by what we've learned, and we're protected by Krishna's promise. That's the no part. Now the yes part again is, free will is still there. And one of the beautiful things that free will is still there is, it's love that's voluntary. Love for Krishna that's not out of fear of, I don't want to go to the bad place again. It's love. We're moved by love. We're protected by love. And because of that love, Krishna gives his protection. He gives his promise. They'll never come back again. Although we still have the free will opportunity. Okay? So that means we have to like really learn a lesson. Not like to say, I don't like it here anymore. I want out of here. Let me out of here. I want to be with Krishna. We have to like squeaky clean. No more free. You know, we know what the mistake was. We're very clear what we want to do, and there's no bungee cord holding us, pulling us back. Krishna will take care of that. It's just so the unalloyed devotion that's required. No mix of anything. No more alloy. Pure, unalloyed love. Like pure gold. No mix. Yes?
So Maharaj, what is holding us here to stay in this material world? We understand that we have to go back. What is holding us?
Okay. I've been waiting to see if you want to say it again. in Bhakti Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami, he raises the question, how did we get here? Because if we understand how we got here, we'll know how to go back where we came from. Like, we came in through the door. So if we want to leave, that's how to get out, through the door. So similarly, we come into the material world he analyzes. Some people say this, that, and the other thing, and he refutes this, that, and the other thing, and comes to the conclusion. It's turning our attention away from Krishna. The Sanskrit he uses is Bahir Mukha Jeev. We turned our attention away from Krishna. So that's what's holding us. That's what brings us here, and that's what's holding us here. So even we know, like theoretically, that's why I'm here, and I want to stop that. I want to turn my attention to Krishna. We don't. Or we do it theoretically. Or we do it inconsistently. That's called anishtita bhakti, unsteady devotion. And that, you know, we turn our attention when we feel the pinch. Ouch! And so we, Krishna! And then the pinch goes away and complacency. I'm comfortable now. What's holding us, which is your question here, is our the weakness of our affinity for Krishna. It's entrepreneurial. It's, you know, we have this, you know, Krishna's got to do these things, and then we'll have a little relationship with Krishna on the side. And if something that Krishna doesn't supply in our little list of things, we've got, you know, he's not a, we may look for another supplier. Have issues with our supplier. He's not supplying. I've got this contract. He's supposed to supply. Anyway, I'm using those, that kind of language, but it's not a, the relationship of love has not fully restored yet. And that's what holds us here. We still want, you know, enjoyment apart from Krishna. It's what brings us here and what holds us here. That enjoyment from apart from Krishna doesn't even exist. It's Maya. That's what Maya means. Not this. There is no happiness apart from Krishna. It's holding on to that expectation of happiness apart from Krishna, even while trying to go back to Krishna. You know, taking our dirty laundry into the kingdom of God. You can't do that. You're not eligible. You got to come in clean. So we need the purification of that tendency, Bahir Mukha Jeev tendency, looking for happiness apart from Krishna. The antidote is love for Krishna, or loving service. So we practice the loving service in a regulative way until purification comes. Then it becomes sufficiently strong, then it's now steady. But even that steady position is not complete. You know the verse from the Bhagavatam, Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Sloki Bhaktir Bhavati Naistuki. So the beginning part of the verse, it's a stage where Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu. Prayeshu means almost. Nashta, almost. Abhadreshu, almost gone. So it's almost gone means where bhakti is strong enough, even this residual tendency doesn't overwhelm the bhakti tendency. There's no off and on. It's on. It stays on. Even though this other tendency is still at that stage, still lingering. It's not strong enough. Bhakti is stronger. So then keep going and keep going. And if you read Madhurya Kadambini, there's a whole, in chapter 4, there's this detailed description of how the, at what stage are anartas completely gone. And when the key, read it carefully, and you'll see that it will achieve that when the chanting of the holy name is done offenselessly. To keep, you know, it's like a long, very complicated section, but that's the essence, the conclusion. Our means to get to that place, where that which is holding us here is completely gone, is through offenseless chanting of the holy name. Because there are other angas of bhakti besides chanting, and they can remove, you know, obstacles or tendencies to a large degree. They certainly assist in the chanting process, but the chanting process is necessary. Offenseless chanting is necessary to completely finish that tendency. So chanting without offense. Well, that's the the question was, what's the cause, and I'm giving the cure for the cause. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives. Yeah.
When you say offenseless chanting, are you referring to the ten offenses?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And you mentioned that there are other angas of bhakti.
Nine. Hearing, chanting, remembering, you know, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. That list? You're familiar?
Yes, Maharaj. But if we are in Kali Yuga, the recommended sacrifice is chanting.
Yes, correct. And we do other things too. We do deity worship. We do prayer. We, you know, we do other things. But the primary one is the primary one. It gives strength to the other ones. Yes.
So, Maharaj, worshipping the Narayan form or Vishnu form of Krishna is same as worshipping Krishna.
It's same, and there's differences also. There's a very one of many beautiful purports in the second canto where Prabhupada is speaking about deity worship. Chapter 8. It's where, anyway, Prabhupada is speaking about worshipping a form of Vishnu, and he lists a number of names of forms of Vishnu. Then he said, or, then another list of names of forms of Vishnu, or another list of names of forms of Vishnu. So, Vishnu Tattva, category. So Narayana is in the Vishnu Tattva, as Krishna is the Vishnu Tattva, and Nrsingha and Varaha and Vamana and Matsya and Kurma, the Leela avatars, and etc., Sitaram, the forms of Vishnu. So in that sense, they're the same. Then there's also distinction, like this Brahma Samhita verse. Goloka namni nijadamni tale chatasya devi maheshu hari dhamasu teshu teshu. It's Golokas, and then another realm. And Krishna resides in Goloka, and Narayan resides in Haridham, and Mahesh resides in Maheshdham, and the Devas reside in Devidham, along with us. So the position of Krishna is the avatari. So there's distinction. In the mood of love in Goloka is a different mood. There's a mood of intimacy that Mother Jasoda chasing after Krishna with a stick in her hand doesn't happen in Vaikuntha. Demanding to look inside Narayan's mouth to see if he's swallowed dirt doesn't happen in Vaikuntha. There's an intimacy of love in Goloka that eclipses, it's so strong, it just eclipses the position of the Supreme Lord as the Supreme Lord. His Aishwarya is there, but the Madhurya is so strong, it's not even recognized. Or if it's recognized, they just forget it because they're overwhelmed in the intimacy of their love for him. So the same, and there's some differences. And the intimacy of the love in Goloka is attractive to those who know and receive that understanding from those who are, you know, in touch with the love of Goloka, the love of Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan. Now, one of the Vaikuntha planets, there's a form of Krishna, Vasudev Krishna, with four arms, with the symbols of Vishnu in the right position, and it's in the mood of Vaikuntha. That intimacy isn't there. That's also a feature of Krishna. And then there's a feature of Krishna who's in the Purusha avatars, in this Devidam realm. You know, like, you know, Lord Shiva, there's complexity, and with Krishna there's complexity too. He's in the heart of every living entity. But that's a feature of him. Vasudev Krishna feature. Janardana feature of Krishna. And then there's Goloka. Vaikuntha Vasis. Yes. Yes. Their love is not mixed. It's unalloyed love. But love in a mood of opulence, Aishwarya. It's not less than love, it's love. It's pure love. But there's then an additional feature of Madhurya. It's a little complicated, but above, at the topmost part of Haridham is Ayodhya, where there's more intimacy than in Narayan and Vaikuntha, but it's still within the upper regions of Haridham. It's still Vaikuntha, but above, intimacy-wise, above. And then there's Goloka. And within Goloka, there's realms. And Dwarka. And Mathura. And Vraja. And in Vraja, there's the greatest degree of intimacy. In Mathura, there's a mix. Just like the mix. Example. One example is Vasudeva and Devaki. So here's Krishna. You know, you have your daughter in your lap. Supposing you had your daughter was born, and you know, 12 years from the very night that she was born, you didn't see her, and then she comes back 12 years later, and stands in front of you. Now, you'd feel something, and your daughter would feel something. But Vasudeva and Devaki were seeing. He just killed Kamsa, just like one. He finished him. Not just like knocked him out, then unconscious. He killed just one fist, a 12-year-old boy. They could understand he's not an ordinary person. He's God. They had seen that night, you know, forearm form. He's and he told them, "I've come in this form so you won't mistake that I'm your child. I'm Vasudev." So as he was standing before then Balaram and Krishna wanted the parental affection of Vasudev and Devaki, but they were in this reverential mood. So Krishna covered them with his Yogamaya potency, and they forgot. He's God. They just treated him like their son. So there's a mix. In Vrindavan, they don't remember at all. In Mathura, they remember and then they forget. And in Dwaraka, the opulence is even greater. It's Dwaraka, you know, the land of all opulence. All opulence. All opulence in full. But there's also some intimacy. The Yadu dynasty and Ugrasena and like that. And Uddhava amongst them all, the most intimately connected with Krishna. And that's also part of Vrajadham or Golokadham. And then Haridham, and then Maheshdham, and then Devidham. In Phoenix. Desert. Yeah. You're asking like three things at once, at least. So your first question is, what is Mahamaya or who is Mahamaya? And then you started saying some other things. So, Mahamaya is the expansion or shadow energy of Rama Devi, or the internal potency of Mahavishnu. I'll explain it in two ways. This is Canto 3, Bhagavatam, and also Brahma Samhita. During this, in the chronology, the setting is that the life of Brahma is over. The universe has been withdrawn. The time energy has been withdrawn. The whole universe is withdrawn. All the elements are again in their unmanifested, undifferentiated, dormant state of pradhan, and all the living entities are in the body of Mahavishnu. And he's enjoying his eternal pastimes with Rama Devi. And, of course, he's existing in eternal time. It's not like, and then some time passes. He's in eternal time. He's not within time as we know it. Two things. The Mahavishnu has a desire or a feeling. He's a person. He has a feeling. And his feeling is, these living entities that are within me, I wish for their ultimate happiness. In this dormant state, susupti state, they're not experiencing that. I wish for them to have that experience of their unlimited fullness of happiness. And a second desire, as he sees it at the distance, this reflection of Rama Devi. She's a reflection of Rama Devi, or in the language of Brahma Samhita, she's like a co-wife, like a maid servant of his wife. Like that, those two terms are used. And he knows that she wants something to do. So she wants some service. So he desires, let me give her some service to do. So he's kind. Is that compassion upon living entities? Compassion upon that reflection energy, Chaya Devi. So he gives her something to do by glancing. And by his glance, Rama Devi, his internal potency, knows his desire. And she takes care of his desire, because that's what the internal potency does. She transfers the living entities that are within his body, along with the transformation of time energy, and entrusts that the living entities and time energy to Shambhu. The halo of the glance of Mahavishnu, zoom, zoom, there he goes, and carries the glance and living entities and time energy and contacting that undifferentiated totality of material energy called pradhan gets agitated, impregnation. And then the elements start to separate and it comes with a different name, mahatattva. It's all, you know, the big broad term is mahamaya. It's the energy, the reflection of the Lord's internal energy is external energy. There's no disconnect. It's just reflection of his internal energy. And then she does a whole bunch of stuff. Like, you know, bewildering living entities with her potencies. So that's who. Then here's another who. The advent of Krishna, Krishna Janmashtami. The first six sons of Devaki were killed. The seventh son is Balaram. Still within the womb of Devaki, Krishna calls Yogamaya. Some service. Yes, I have some service for you. Oh, very good. In fact, here's a series of services. One, transfer Balaram from the womb of Devaki to the womb of Rohini. Next, take birth then as the daughter of Yashoda. Number three, I will take birth as the eighth child of Devaki, and the night of my appearance, I'll have Vasudev carry me by the side of Yashoda, place me by the side of Yashoda so she doesn't even know that the children got switched, and Vasudev's going to bring you over here to the prison house. But don't worry, because you can't be killed. You're my energy. You're Yogamaya. He'll come to try to kill you. Like, you know, the script is already written. And here's what's going to happen. He's going to come and try to kill you. He won't be able to kill you. And then after that, here's the next service. You'll be known throughout the land by various names. Durga, Parvati, Mahakali, Maya. Now, he's talking to Yogamaya and saying, this is another service for you. So who is she? She's the reflection of the internal potency, known as the external potency. That's who she is. And she has a service to keep people, you know, attracted to enjoying in a way that there's no enjoyment there. You know, water in the desert. Desert, by definition, is there's no water. This material world, by definition, is a place by design where there's no happiness, but Maya makes it look like there's happiness. That's what she does. That's who she is, and there's what she does. And she'll continue to do that as long as the living entity is thinking there's some happiness out there. But when the living entity understands, whoa, wait a minute, real happiness is my relationship with Krishna. Now, then that energy just acts in a different way. It's a facility for service. Now here's a couch. I'm sitting on the couch, being used in Krishna's service. And someone else, same couch or same whatever it is, material energy, can think, hey, here's enjoyment apart from Krishna. It's the consciousness makes the feature work this way or that way. So we can convert Mahamaya into Yogamaya by the agency of devotion to Krishna. That's the power of bhakti. It's like, you know, taking an electric wire and running electricity through it. It acts electrified. It's just a copper wire. It's not electricity, but it's conducting electricity. So this material energy can act in a spiritual way if the consciousness of the person who's interacting with that energy is, you can say, like electrified or spiritualized. And then the energy can act in a spiritual way. Here's the Bhagavad Gita. What makes this Bhagavad Gita or the Bible, the Holy Bible or the Holy Quran or Bhagavad Gita sacred? Like any other book, it's wood, cotton, and minerals put together in, you know, some fashion. Huh? Yeah. It's the message of God presented in this form. Because it's the message of God, it acts in a way that can change people's lives. Not just like, you know, a notion. It can cleanse the heart and change consciousness. It can act in a spiritual way. Or a deity. Or mantra. Or, you know, prasadam. From a materialist point of view, come on. So you guys are vegetarian, that's good. But from our perspective, it's not just vegetarian, it's prasadam. Why? Why is it prasadam? It was prepared with the consciousness of offering it to Krishna, and it was offered to Krishna, and Krishna, because of that love and devotion with which it was offered, Krishna accepted it. And one who takes it, they don't even have to know that it's prasadam, it's going to act. From material perspective, it's matter, or matter that you can say spiritualized, or that it becomes sanctified. So Mahamaya can be converted into Yogamaya by the agency of bhakti. And that, so by one who's carrying bhakti within their heart, they can transform this place into Vaikuntha by consciousness. Now, things are still going to perish because matter is perishable. But the action of the place can act spiritually. It's a function of consciousness. So that's a long answer for what's Mahamaya and where, you know, who is she? She facilitates, well, she has two services. The primary service is to keep really people really busy in forgetfulness of Krishna. Because they want forgetfulness of Krishna, they want enjoyment apart from Krishna, so she gives them lots of stuff to do. So much so, they don't have time. Just ask them. No time. Really busy. That's not the ultimate purpose. That's okay. Because two things. Mahamaya can act in a different way. Here's a couch. Now here's a cell phone. Technology. You know, it can be used in Krishna service. It can be used for Maya. You know, the body. It gives us an opportunity to serve Krishna, or it can be an opportunity for sense gratification. That's how the consciousness behind that which is the purpose of creation, ultimately, as I described earlier, is Krishna's giving a facility for the living entities who are forgetful of Him to again become mindful of Him. No, the living entities aren't created. The living entities are eternal. The soul is eternal, co-eternal with God. And because we're tiny parts of Him, we have tiny quantity of His qualities, which includes free will. He has unlimited free will. We have tiny free will. And we can use it properly or not use it properly. There's freedom. Limited. Not unlimited. And when, according to how we, you or I or us, use our free will, he reciprocates. He's neutral. You want to be in Maya? I don't recommend it, but if that's what you want, here it is. And meanwhile, while you're in Maya, you know, please remember Krishna, because it's really not what you think it is. It's, in fact, it's illusion. It's illusory happiness and illusory distress. It's illusion. So please come to reality. All the while reminding us, please come to reality. But we don't have to say yes, we can say no. I like my version of pursuing happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. All living entities are created, endowed with their creator, with these inexorable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, great statesmen make these statements. And so Krishna doesn't interfere. But he's reminding us, and so if we hear that reminder, then free will can be exercised in a different way. And then that same Mahamaya acts as a facility for devotional service. And then the purpose of creation is fulfilled. So your question, why creation? Why did he make this place? We do stupid things. Because we wanted it. Don't blame Krishna. He was saying no. We're saying yes. Saying, well, it won't be nice. Yeah, let me try. Like children. Misuse of free will. The good news is, you know, that the vast majority of living entities are in the spiritual world. And we're a small minority over here that, you know, misuse their free will. And, you know, school of hard knocks. But all the while, Krishna giving messages. Lots of them. And sending representatives and instruments and, you know, on his behalf, carrying his message and so forth. He's not just letting us go astray without any effort to bring us back. He's appealing over and over, come back to me. And Mahamaya can act as an agency of bringing us back, depending on how we regard Prakriti, material nature. It's a facility to exploit, or it's a facility to offer service to Krishna. And it acts in a liberating way if we regard Prakriti as an opportunity to offer service to Krishna. Wow, 9:30. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.